This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Daniel Pinkwater is our guest in this portion of the show. He's a writer. He does commentary for All Things Considered. And he and Scott Simon produce and host the public radio program Chinwag Theater. Daniel writes books for readers of all ages, but I suspect he favors the elementary school crowd. And that is a very demanding crowd. Daniel Pinkwater and his wife, Jill, who is also a writer and illustrates Daniel's books, live in upstate New York on a farm with some furry friends. Both cats and dogs are well-loved, but I think Daniel would own up to favoring the canines. Daniel Pinkwater has written dozens of books, including The Afterlife Diet, Hoboken Fish and Chicago Whistle, and Super Puppy. His latest book is just out from Simon & Schuster. It's called Uncle Boris in the Yukon and Other Shaggy Dog Stories. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. If you join the conversation, you'll have a chance to win a copy of Uncle Boris in the Yukon. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Daniel Pinkwater, good afternoon. Welcome.
How do you do, Celeste?
I am very fine.
I'd like to, first of all, just respond
yes.
to something you said.
Yes.
I do not favor canines. Any cats listening who are offended, I want you to know that I'm working on a cat book.
Okay.
And I like them equally well.
Very good.
I am not a dog person or a cat person. People always like to use that as a category.
Yeah. Well,
I don't agree with it.
Okay. I like them equally well as well, although at the moment I'm only living with a cat.
If I had to pick one to live with, if there were some kind of draconian law and you could only have one pet, I'd have a cat. But that doesn't mean that I don't like dogs equally well.
Very good. And what about my assumption about, you know, who you like to write for?
I regard writing for kids as my excuse for being on this earth, although we're talking today about nominally an adult book, but I do like to write for children just because they're better readers than adults. Adults are people who read as a means of getting off to sleep, mostly. So the average commercial popular writer, not that I'm either of those things, is really making a sleeping aid. Whereas if you write for kids, you're writing for people who haven't been reading so long that they've become habituated, and they exercise more taste. If they don't like something, they won't read it.
Well, I finished your book before I went to bed last night, and I did not fall asleep.
Until you were done.
Until I was done.
Well, thank you very much. You're the good kind of adult reader.
Well, thank you very much for that. What do you say we talk with a listener?
With pleasure.
On line one in Champaign, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a question which I don't know if Mr. Pinkwater wants to be self-disclosing or not, but I've read quite a number of your books, mostly many to my son, some and daughter, some to my on my own, and I've noticed you sort of hint often at some sort of Zen background, but you never say very much about it, and I wondered if you would say something about it, and if that is so, if how that influenced your writing.
What's there to say?
Well, that's up to you.
Well, that was my answer. Zen, as I understand it, is or has been defined as a special transmission without dependence on words or scriptures. Therefore, I assume it is necessary for me to comment on it verbally. I could, however, I could hum for you, or I could tell you that I am sitting in a perfectly erect posture.
Well, okay, but it's your freedom to say as you wish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Your books are made for reading out loud, I think, Daniel Pinkwater. Do you, when you write them, are you speaking them out loud?
I'm hearing them, and it's true. And certainly becoming in my middle years a radio character has been a lot of help, really. It's been a good school. I think I'm much more about telling than reading. Some authors are really about writing, reading and writing, and what they make their books out of is what they've read. I'm always listening to people, listening for voices and hearing them. This is not anything clinical. It's just something I'm tuned for. And yes, indeed, it's the cadences are the cadences of speech. I like that. I love conversation. I love people who can tell a story, and I love the various differences in human speech, accents, and personal idiosyncrasies. All of that. So you're right on the money. It's about that.
Yeah. And in your family growing up, were there great storytellers?
Some were great, some were near great. All
That's
of them had accents.
And what a character Uncle Boris was.
Uncle Boris, I won't say he doesn't belong in this book. He leads off the book. But the Uncle Boris chapter was just something. Sometimes you just write something. You just sit down and you write it, and you don't even know what it is. You don't even know why you're doing it. It's usually taking place early in the morning or late at night. And then you keep writing it because you started it, and when you're finished, you say, what is this? So that's the Uncle Boris chapter. It existed before the rest of the book, and it was sort of like knocking around, but I sure wasn't going to waste an opportunity to publish it in something because it's so good.
It is very good, and it's very Shaggy.
It's the story, and it's the only Shaggy Dog story in the book, which was titled, not by me, but by the publisher, who's a nice guy, and it seemed to give him pleasure to make up a title, so I didn't argue. But the Uncle Boris story is the story of an uncle of mine, based on a real uncle of mine, who was quite an adventurer in his time and claimed to have been the first private person to fly in an airplane in Poland and the first private person to own a movie camera, and he was a great amateur cinematographer. He came to live with us periodically, or sponge off us. He'd just live in the back bedroom, and after a while he acquired a wife, and they would both live in the back bedroom, and then they would go visit some other relative for a few months and work their way back around to us. He loved to shoot movies, and I was a little tiny child, and he'd take me to the park, and we'd photograph squirrels and things, and he was quite an enchanting old European forger and confidence man who had come here on a handmade passport.
Mm. I would love to see the movie that he put together with all your family's feet.
That movie existed up till a few years ago, and it was on nitrate film, which is flammable. Well, I won't finish the story, but a lot of masterpieces were lost.
Oh. That sounds like a sad story.
Well, the films were described. I even wrote about, someone else wrote about them based on something I'd written in a hoity-toity film magazine. So somewhere in the record of film history, his feet work is, I better tell the audience, someone had sold him a movie camera at some point and said to him, then you're taking a movie, always include the feet. By which I assume the salesman in the Photoshop meant be far enough away to show the whole figure from head to toe. But my uncle somehow grasped the concept of the panning shot, so what he would always do is descend with the camera down to the feet and then sort of linger on the feet as though that were very important in making a record of any person. He and his brother, my father, also got the cinema bug, and they shot a lot of movies, and they once edited together all the footage of feet into one long film showing everybody's feet. Feet standing still, feet of people seated in a row on a sofa, feet walking towards you down the pavement. It was foot after foot of feet. As far as I know, there was nothing tongue-in-cheek about this. They were just seriously making a film that they thought had some sort of importance.
Hmm. I can see the reviews now, you know, two thumbs up, fabulous footage.
Or two toes up.
Two toes up. There you go, of
yes.
Course. Of course. Another listener is waiting to talk with us. In Champaign on line one, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a big fan of Daniel Pinkwater.
How big are you?
We just finished reading Alan Mendelssohn, Boy from Mars, with our kids last night.
That's big.
And I have to say that I would have done a lot better at going to college if I hadn't been studying next to the young adult section in the library.
Uh-huh.
Hey, actually, you pretty much answered one of my questions. I was going to ask how much of your Uncle Boris was in Alan Mendelssohn's Leonard Niebuhr's Uncle Boris, but obviously with the footage of the feet, that creeps into Alan Mendelssohn, Boy from Mars, too.
I tend to retread a lot of elements in characters, and I tend to make characters as composites. A little of me, a little of someone else, something I heard, something I made up out of whole cloth, and some parts will show up again, either the same character or as attributes of another character. I don't make any apology for this. It gives scholars something to do.
What about one of the most fascinating things to me are your protagonists. They're definitely not the normal idea of everyone's hero. What kind of ideas, what's your basis of going about making a protagonist for one of your books?
When I started writing children's books, which is what we're really talking about, mm-hmm. I really thought, I'll do one, maybe I'll get to do two. When I hit three, I'll be done. Because I didn't think there was really an audience for more, because what I was interested in, and the notion that came to me in the beginning, which is still the way I approach writing these things, is it turns out I'm good at revisiting my own childhood. And I can get back there really readily now because I've done it so much. But, you know, little sense memory things, an odor, you know, it's Marcel Proust territory. Something will get me there. And then I can reconstruct and imagine with considerable vividness what my world was. And right down to textures and fragrances and, you know, the kinds of fabrics that existed then and not so much now, and the smell of furniture polish and sunbeams with dust motes and given moments, just the way that time passes when you're, say, 8 years old as opposed to when you're some other age. The purpose for doing this was never to depict that world, but to create something that that kid, who I was and know intimately, would have been delighted with, theory being, if I like it, somebody else will. I assumed starting in that after about three books, I would have served all the kids who had much in common with the kid I was. And that kid would have been delighted with a book about a relative outsider, somebody who was possibly a little on the rumpled and chubby side, somebody bright but not necessarily quick of tongue or witty or admired by adults, a real kid such as I was. Well, it turns out there's no end of kids who either are like that or perceive themselves as being like that. So it's now 90 books later. They're not all the same, but a great many of them have these elements in common, and the kids are still with me. So, and there are several generations of them, I should add. So that's how that is. The protagonists, it's a little of me, and it's a little bit of a hero that I would have been gratified by, because instead of being someone I could never be, it would be someone I could possibly be.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I never gave a straight answer like that before. What's wrong with me?
You're slipping.
Ah, I've got to have another cup of coffee.
Well, while you do that, have a sip of coffee, I'll reintroduce you. Daniel Pinkwater is our guest here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Uncle Boris in the Yukon and Other Shaggy Dog Stories. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged this afternoon, and if you join the conversation, you'll have a chance to win a copy of Uncle Boris in the Yukon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
We should emphasize that this is meant to be an adult book. Not that I see much difference, but that's how it's published.
Yeah. Well, I would think middle school and beyond. What do you think?
I never even guess anymore, because I'll write a novel, which in which I have done my very best to show my best tricks, and I'll get mail from 8-year-olds who not only read it but can understand it and criticize it. I also get mail from grown-ups who are reading picture books I wrote and sometimes don't get them. So I just, you know, I write them, somebody else decides where they go, but this was meant to be an adult book, and so I'm going to stick to my story. It's an adult book.
Okay.
A kid could read it.
And it's a darn fine adult book with darn fine illustrations.
Well, darn fine, I'll accept that. Would you like to give it a letter grade if between A and D?
I would give it an A.
You give it an A. How would you grade it, Celeste, in terms of its potential as an appreciated and enjoyable gift?
I think it's more than suitable for gift wrapping.
So you'd give it another A?
I would.
I'm satisfied with this interview. Please continue.
I want to know, how's Jill?
Yes.
Her drawings are in this book.
Aren't they fine?
Yes, they are terrific.
Aren't they outstandingly funny and at the same time beautiful and at the same time intellectually stimulating drawings?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Intellectually stimulating might
well,
be.
Well, you look at them. There's material there. Those are not, they're not simple-minded or rote. They've got a little quality. You can live with these drawings.
They're loaded with character and love.
You wanted to ask?
I wanted to ask you about when you first saw the picture where Lulu is giving you a big hug when Jill drew that.
Yes.
How did you receive that picture?
Well, I thought she made me look fat, but I'll tell you something else about Jill as an artist. Jill was in her 50s. We're both of us 97 years old now. Jill was in her 50s. Her mother is a painter, yeah, to this day. But not the nicest woman, I'm not embarrassed to say. And her talented daughters she educated but said, "Don't do art. That's mine." Well, when you get that sort of injunction early, you listen to it. So Jill hadn't done any drawing. She hadn't picked up a pencil for 20 years. She was in my office. She picked up a folder and asked me, "What's this?" And she was actually just trying to see if I was still alive, because it's hard to tell when I'm working, thinking, or sleeping. They look the same. And I said, "That needs illustrations. It's a story of mine." She said, "How about I illustrate it?" "Sure, go ahead," I said. Take a pad, help yourself to whatever you want, and go ahead, see what you can do." She came back in an hour with some sketches that were so remarkable, they just knocked me out. And, you know, in an instant, because I know a thing or two about these matters, I realized she can draw the way I would draw if I could really draw. It was no trouble persuading the publisher to change the contract so that she was the illustrator. Sight unseen, I didn't even have to make an argument. I just said, here's a strange notion. What if my wife did the pictures instead of me? And the editor said, "Great idea," as though she'd ever seen a thing she'd drawn. Well, Jill, since then, has done about 20 books. They're very well received. I love what she does. It's very exciting. And it's simply better than what I was doing. I feel no reason to continue to draw. I can just write, because what she draws is so satisfying to me. Yeah. It's exciting.
Yeah. And you're the one who went to art school.
I went to art school, which is the problem, I think.
Hmm.
It's often the problem.
Yeah.
Going to art school.
It was love at first sight, you and Jill.
Pretty much. Pretty much. On my side, it definitely was. I don't know what she was thinking, because I didn't give her a chance. I didn't leave that woman alone for a second until she was married to me.
Now, your account of your first encounter in Uncle Boris in the Yukon left me with some questions.
Well, you could try them on me.
Okay. When you first saw Jill, you were in your car, and she was walking down the street?
No! No, that was a little artistic license, but it could have been that.
It could have been that.
It was that instantaneous.
So there's a little shagginess in this story then, too.
Well, you know, I'm writing a book. I can't if I were to just give a straight account of what happened, I'd be bored and you'd be bored.
Mm.
But it is as though I glimpsed her from the window of my car. I glimpsed her, put it that way, and I knew right away. As a matter of fact, there was an internal dialogue because I was poised to enter her apartment. My finger was still on the doorbell when I saw her for the first time, and I think I heard a voice. I think I heard a voice within me say, "If you step through that threshold, you will marry this woman." And I responded to the voice, "Well, then," my natural male instinct, "well, I won't step through." And then I felt something push me or possibly kick me, and I was in the room, and all was lost.
Hmm.
I'm not sorry for a second.
What were your first words to her?
I think I said, "Do you have anything to drink?" She made me some iced tea.
Uh-huh.
And then I sort of, she says I worked my way around the room like a rat, working around the corners of the edges of the room, looking at the pictures on the wall, not stepping out in the middle, sipping the iced tea. And the next thing I remember, we were married 6 weeks later.
Wow.
That was more than 30 years ago, so obviously it wasn't a mistake.
Yeah. Now, do you guys do anything special on your anniversary?
Usually we fight.
About anything in particular?
Yes.
Oh, what do you fight about?
Anything in particular.
Anything in particular. So is it your 31st that's coming up, or more than 31st?
I can't recall. It's something like the 32nd.
Yeah. My husband and I also have a difficult time sometimes remembering how long it's been.
Well, I mean, we're just dealing with this life, but it's clear that this is one of those continuing things because of the instant recognition, because we both changed, or I say we both changed our ways completely. She initiated a policy of acquiring large numbers of animals as soon as we were married, as though it had been planned before or was destined. And I went along with it as though I had no choice. And again, I'm not sorry.
I don't think you have. No. From what I've read, artistic license or not, you have everything to be happy about.
She has red hair, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen her picture on the web.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Very handsome couple.
At pinkwater.com?
Yes, I think.
There might be a Jill site, and she didn't tell me.
Oh, I haven't checked that out. I suppose we should. But somewhere on the web, I did see a nice picture of you and Jill standing side by side in front, in back of
Lulu.
In back of an easy chair with Lulu.
Lulu is a 4-month-old puppy, fresh from her mother, who was fresh from the Arctic. Lulu was an Inuit sled dog. Her mother was pulling a sled for an indigenous person in Arctic Canada and dealing with polar bears a month before Lulu was introduced to this world, and she's completely unsuitable as a pet, but we have considerable experience as dog trainers, and she's working out all right, and we're very much in love.
Yeah. Well, she's at once she's gentle and fierce, isn't she?
She's not so much fierce as intense and dangerous.
Okay. She curls around you like smoke. That sounds fairly gentle and dangerous, doesn't
and
it?
And sexy.
Yeah.
that's my best line in the whole book.
Yeah.
But she's like that. She's very, very seductive for a big, heavy dog of must be close to 90 pounds now. She's amazingly, amazingly light and flies and floats, dances, and every morning there's this little sort of stamping dance of joy that there's nothing bad that can happen to me as long as I have this dog, because every morning when I come down, she usually gives me some time to make my morning ablutions and sort of get fully awakened before she appears. And then her tail is wagging furiously, and then she just stamps with those enormous snowshoe feet and dances all around me just to welcome me to awakeness. And no matter what happens, the day can't get too bad after that.
Hmm. What is it, you suppose, about you and animals? What has drawn you to these, to animals, especially the Malamutes?
Well, the Malamutes are simply an aberration and the result of having read something by that fool Conrad Lorenz. Conrad Lorenz, beware of good writers. I guess that includes me. Beware of good writers. They're persuasive, and they generally don't know what they're talking about. Conrad Lorenz was an animal behaviorist. He had quite a vogue in the, I guess, the 60s and 70s, an Austrian, who came up with a theory completely cockamamie that there were two races of dogs. Anytime somebody gets into theories with a race in them, you know, you should back way off. His theory was there's one race of dogs that's descended from the lowly jackal. And these are the fawning, perennially immature, infantile, friendly little dogs that just want your approval. The other is the kind of dog descended from the noble wolf. And this dog is aloof and kind of feline and noble and tests you. And you must be worthy of this dog to have his respect. And, of course, this is all of it complete hogwash. All dogs, he would have known this if he just looked at some bones. All dogs are descended from wolves. This includes the Chihuahua, the Pekingese, the Greyhound, the Cocker Spaniel, you name it. The original ancestor is still running around up in the North Woods howling. And they're all canines, and they're all descended from the wolf. And this whole jackal thing is just some nonsense of his. And his reason for it was because he had crossbred dogs, which were half Chow Chow and half German Shepherd. So he had a on one side the northern race, which is a kind of a type of dog, the wolf spitz type. They tend to be a little bit like he said, but really very little. And the other side, the Alsatian, which is almost the same thing, but a more domesticated domestic dog. And he thought that was the perfect dog. So he basically inductively created a natural history to make this breed what it was, this crossbreed. All nonsense. In fact, I wrote something in the book. This is the end of the chapter where I more or less lay out the same things I just told you. Naturally, I felt for the whole romance, only I was sure that I wanted to have a pure experience with a pure wolf-descended dog. This inclination was related to the fact that men, no matter how ridiculous their physique, will stand in front of a mirror flexing their muscles. I saw myself as some kind of Nordic or Eskimo Jewish barbarian, clad in furs and foot rags with my noble wolf by my side. Sled dogs look like wolves. They like to pose for pictures, standing on some rock, gazing into the distance, looking like Siegfried. But they are thinking at such a moment when the last rays of the sun are hitting their grizzled and handsome coats and their intelligent profiles are to be seen at their best is probably, "Soon I will move my bowels." "Yes, that is what I will do." Or, "If I pee on this rock, other dogs will come and smell it and know I was here."
That's terrific.
So, the noble northern dog. But once we started with them, we discovered what they were really like, and they really are wolf-like. And that means they're sneaky, immoral, foolish, and funny. And we enjoy that. Both Jill and I, as younger people, chose to always work with the toughest and most dangerous delinquent kids and never wanted to teach normal kids because there wasn't enough going on. So, I mean, even this morning at breakfast, I'm watching Lulu trying to steal food. And I say, "Lulu," this is after 5 years and as many times as there have been mornings, "Lulu, don't steal." And she looks at me and with her wolf eyes and says, "What do you mean, don't steal?" And this will go on for the rest of her life. And the reason I tell her not to is just to enjoy the fact that the concept is completely beyond her grasp. Don't steal? How do you mean, don't steal?
Yeah. That's hardwired.
Theft is what I do.
That's right.
It's what I am. Or Lulu, what are you doing? Only stealing. I'm just stealing some things. All right.
Let's talk with some more listeners. We're going to go to a caller who's on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to tell Mr. Pinkwater that I really, really love his reviews on Saturday mornings with Scott Simon.
I really, really thank you for mentioning them.
They are absolutely delightful, and we've gone out and bought a couple of books. We bought one book, and I've been looking for another book that was in your review. We love them.
You do not have to worry. When we do one of those books, they are always good.
Good.
There's one coming up this coming weekend, unless there's some news that bumps it.
Oh, okay.
I love doing those pieces with Scott.
Well, we'll listen for it.
Thank you.
I also had a question concerning a comment that you made to the previous caller about your protagonist being somewhat of a misfit.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you think of Harry Potter and his being a misfit, and do you like the series, and what do you think of...
Delighted to be able to say I haven't read them yet.
Oh, yeah.
I will, but not right away. I never read big blockbuster bestsellers then. I read them later.
I see.
My wife read them all. She said they were good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, we didn't discuss it. I said, how'd you like the Harry Potter books? She said, they were good.
Okay, well, I just...
So I assume they're good.
I found that similarity in your description of your protagonist with Harry Potter.
I think it is pretty much a given for a lot of children's literature, because you know, as I was too dense to know when I blundered into the field,
mm-hmm.
Everybody growing up at some point, but at various points, feels totally out of it, and so if you write a book where somebody who's totally out of it catches on in some way or survives by his wits, then it's going to be appealing. It's pretty simple. But I just, I was too dense to have figured it out without just airing into it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That's why most of us love Huck Finn.
Oh, there's lots and lots of examples.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, that what did I know? I mean, I'm not a very good thinker. I'm a good teller.
Before we go to the next caller, I wanted to ask you about your sister, Inga. And it seems to me she played a tremendous role in your becoming a reader.
Oh, yes. All the names have been changed because the book isn't quite nonfiction. But she's a real sister, and she's still among us. And she's a magnificent person. She's so magnificent and has such a clear-sighted view that people ask her, how come you don't write? She said, because I do something that's so much more important than writing, she says. I read.
Mm. What does she do?
She reads.
Okay.
She raised children.
Uh-huh.
She helped run a swim school for 40 years.
Hmm. I hope you all get together from time to time, your whole family. And
that's too scary. The whole family?
Well, maybe not the whole family.
Not all at once.
Not the pre-civilized ones.
Not all at once. but she's very, and this is a sister who the listeners need to be kept up with us, read to me all through my childhood, even unto the point where I could read perfectly well by myself. She read to me anyway, every night. So that, you know, at the age of 8, she read me Huck Finn, and I read it myself right after she got done reading it to me. And she read stuff that she wanted to read, and she had good taste. And also, there were lots of things that she had missed growing up. The boy books. This was back then. There were boy books and girl books.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all I had to do was indicate a slight preference for piracy. And she found plenty of the best pirate books. We had, I would say, close to a year of pirate books. And they were mighty good. Those pirates were wonderful characters. And, of course, this is all stuff that she hadn't gotten the first time through childhood. And she's apparently repeated this stuff with her own children and grandchildren. She's still doing it.
She's still guiding
people's reading.
I bet she's a terrific mother and grandmother.
And she's responsible for this book, because she's the one who said to me, you know, you're a good enough writer, but when you write about dogs, you write your best.
Hmm.
So I said, well, okay, I'll get right on it.
Well, now we'll see when the cat book comes out.
Well, I haven't really written anything about cats ever that I can remember, but I've been storing up the stories. And there's a cat that will be in the book who is a hero to me. I also think that I can write a cat book that's good enough that it does not have to have the chapter that all other cat books have, Are Cats Psychic? Or the chapter, Cats of Famous People, Cats in History, or the Strange Folklore and Customs of Humans Pertaining to Cats. All of that will be left out of my book, but I'm going to tell some cat biographies. Mm. And one of the cats is my personal hero. That's as much as I will say at this time.
Okay. Is Jill at work on the illustrations or not quite
No,
yet?
She hasn't. She has much to do before she gets to that, and we tend to work close to the wire because we're not making that much money. So we have to have a disciplined production. You can't think ahead.
Okay. Well, let's talk with another listener on line 4 in Danville. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Mr. Pinkwater, I'm not familiar with you, but just listening to you, I know I'd like to have you as a next-door neighbor.
No, you wouldn't. I'd have all these noisy animals.
Uh-huh.
I'd have all these dogs.
So?
But if that wouldn't bother you, I'll move right in.
No, you don't want to move into this building, but but you sound, very interesting. And if your wife's been with you 30 years, she must be a great deal like you.
Now, let me tell you what I'm like as a neighbor.
What?
I've always avoided local publicity where I live because I just like to live a normal life. So I never granted interviews in the local paper.
Yeah.
I just went about my way. And but at one point, I got involved with a very talented guy named Tony Off, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist. And we did a comic strip. It was launched in, I forget, about 15 years ago. But it was a national thing. It was like went out in 70 papers to begin with. And I really wanted it to be a success. So I gave an interview to the local TV and the local paper. And the local TV piece went like this. You've probably wondered who the fat man in the Woody Allen hat with the big dog was, wandering around during the day when he should be working. Turns out, it's Daniel Pinkwater. And then I was walking in the park with my dog, and this woman comes up to me and says, "Oh, so you write a comic strip?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Oh, what a relief. I was afraid." So that's what I'm like as a neighbor.
I love it. Do you know if any of your books are on tape?
Some of them are, but those tapes are bootleg tapes. The company that did them never paid me. And so if you get them, make copies for your friends. And if your public radio station carries Chinwag Theater, which is free to the station, so you can make them take it, which has me and Scott Simon reading mostly my books, but a lot of children's books, then you can tape that off your radio.
Yeah, well, that would be only a portion, right?
No, we read the whole book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a weekly program, and if the book is short, we read it in one go, and if it's not, we read it as a to-be-continued, and we have more fun, which is good because we hardly get paid anything, but we have more fun doing it than anything else. See, he's a serious newsman, but he loves to play. And this way he can play and not have to go right to an anthrax story.
Mm.
And I, of course, can't do anything but play, so I'm just there.
See, that's what I said. I'd love to have you as a neighbor.
All right, I'll check out the real estate. Where are you? Danville? I'll look it over. You're the only person who's indicated that you would tolerate us.
Okay, well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thanks for calling. Let's talk with another listener, this one on line 2 in Champaign. Hi.
Hello?
That's you.
Okay. I wanted to express my appreciation for Roger's Umbrella of some time ago, and also Aunt Lulu, another Lulu that you wrote, Mr. Pinkwater.
Well, the dog is named after the character.
Well, I wondered if there might be some connection, but it's a great
character's
book.
The character's a librarian who has a sled team in Alaska, and when she comes back to New Jersey, having done her assignment in Alaska, she brings all the Huskies with her.
Well, and I must say, I'm sure your wife is absolutely tops, but gosh, you know, you're no slouch when it comes to illustrations, so it's a pity to lose.
Oh, the whole not pack. If you've seen hers.
Pardon me?
Have you seen her work?
Oh, yes, I have, but I just particularly like yours because it comes from your personality, which is something that I particularly enjoy.
Well, we
and
just
I
have
also
the one personality between us, you know.
I'm not hearing you too well over my telephone, but I do want to ask you about the last time you were in Urbana. You said that you were impressed with Jumer's Castle Lodge, and you were going to write a book about that sometime. I'm just wondering if it's germinating.
It hasn't turned up, but I have all the literature that I took with me, and this was more than 10 years ago.
I didn't think you'd need the literature. I thought maybe just the impression would be enough.
The impression is there, but certainly it will show up because
okay.
I thought it was just it was a wonderful spot. I had a good time, and
well,
of course,
we loved
I had
you.
Been there before.
Yes, well,
because I was
going
to go to the university.
Well, it was a great visit then, and it's wonderful to hear you on the radio now.
Thank you.
You have a huge fan club, I want you to know, coast to coast.
I'm delighted. I wish they'd buy a lot more books.
Well, they're all writers, and
oh, that's too bad.
They have their MFAs, and they sing your praises all the time.
Yeah, but that means they can't afford to buy books.
Well, there is something to that, but I'm like the other lady. I have gone to the store after hearing you read, you would talk with Scott Simon and bought those books outright. I mean, it's just extremely persuasive.
Well, I'll tell you why that segment works so well. It is not on a timetable. When it began in the usage of radio, they said, well, now that we've agreed to do this, we'll do it every 2 weeks, every month. What do you want? And I said, let's do it roughly once a month, but mainly let's do it when we find a really good book.
Perfect.
And so sometimes you won't hear me for a couple of months because I didn't come up with something that
that worries me when I don't hear you. So I'm glad you explained that.
It takes all the pressure off saying, well, this is good enough and it's time to do the segment.
Yeah.
It's now I call the producer. Sometimes she finds the book.
Uh-huh.
But we have to agree.
Well,
it's wonderful. And we do it when we have the right book. So they're always right. And I'm very pleased over the years to have brought a lot of these books to people's attention. A lot of them are books that weren't being particularly well publicized. In some cases, they'd been out for a couple of years and hadn't done well. And having heard it on the program, lots of people became interested, and the author got a nice check, and it just makes me feel really good.
Well, we can't hear enough about books on the radio, that's for sure. So thank you for this great thrill.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Daniel, what advice do you have for grown-ups when it comes to selecting books for children? And I know we've got a big, you know, gift-giving season upon us now. You got any advice?
I should, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
I don't. I can't think of a thing that to say except that when I select books for children, they have to be books that I like and am responding to. I never assume. And this is what librarians used to say to me during the Goosebumps years.
Mm-hmm.
Goosebumps were these completely worthless books that had scary themes, and there was also, I think, some rip-offs of extra disgusting books. And they said, well, I don't like them, but the kids do. And you can say that about Barney the Dinosaur and a lot of bad television like that. And they say, well, I don't like it, but the kids seem to respond. And then, of course, if you look at the television, I'll just use television because it's a clearer demonstrator. They're also selling them junky toys and sugar cereal. And the kids will like that, too, because they're not used to resisting sales pitches. It hasn't been that long that they've been on this earth, and they haven't learned that everybody is not really somebody with their welfare in mind. So when I pick a book to read on the radio or to present with Scott Simon on the Weekend Edition Saturday, not only do I think the book has virtues that would appeal to a reader, it's appealing to me. If it doesn't appeal to me, mm-hmm. if I can't like it, there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think lots of people, they buy toys for their kids that they don't see the point of. They buy books for their kids that they don't see the point of. And I always suspect those. I suspect that maybe there isn't a point. And the kid has been stampeded by the hype, and the adult is saying, well, this is approved. You know, Barney the Dinosaur is the good housekeeping seal of approval, but Barney the Dinosaur is junk. Barney the Dinosaur is tasteless and ugly, and you know, I'm particularly embarrassed that it's on public television, and it's just a swindle. It's just being put over like a lot of other junk that we sell to kids or sell to parents in this society. So you got to like it. If it doesn't make sense to you, it's not an appropriate book.
Shaggy, dog stories were very popular in my family growing up. Can I tell you the punchline from one that my father told often?
If you must.
I must. I want to share this with you.
We'll all tolerate it.
Okay. Here's the punchline. I wouldn't send a knight like you out on a dog like this.
Ah, yes. And no one ever hurts the person who tells these stories. They always let them live.
I had to share that.
Thank you.
You're welcome, I guess. Thank you for letting me share that, and my apologies.
I had no way of stopping you.
That's
your radio program.
Yeah. Well,
true. I'll just play along.
And you're in New York, and
yes,
I'm
yeah.
in Illinois.
Besides, I'm a professional. I know when to shut up and let the other person say something embarrassing.
Well, thank you for that.
All right.
And I hope we'll talk again at some point in the future. And
let me suggest when we should.
Okay.
There's another book coming out.
All right.
That's called Super Puppy. It's been out for 25 years,
yeah.
but it's been revised
okay.
for the new millennium. And that's the one that is the How to Do It dog book.
Right.
And it was mainly written and completely controlled by Jill. So my tendencies are at a minimum.
Okay. Hey, next time when we talk about that book,
yes,
could we get Jill on the phone too?
I doubt it.
Oh, all right.
I mean, I could try and persuade her. She did it once, and she was very good at it, but she says she doesn't like talking on the radio.
Oh.
Can you imagine?
No.
I could have her. We could have her in the room, and I could relay questions to her and relay answers back, and then she might get impatient with me and pick up the extension.
Okay.
Maybe that would work.
All right. Well, we'll give it a try. In the meantime, thank you so much. Take care.
I had fun. Thank you.
Okay. Daniel Pinkwater has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for Uncle Boris in the Yukon and other Shaggy Dog Stories. The book is published by Simon & Schuster.